Alicia Johnson is not alone in having a disappointing travel experience. J.D. Power reported that customer satisfaction with air travel in March of 2022 had decreased from the same time a year earlier. Michael Taylor attributes that change to the increase in the number of passengers. He said, "It's a great flight when you're on a 737 and there are only 10 people on it. When there are 220 people on it, that's a different experience." Alicia Johnson also saw the cost of her round-trip ticket to Minneapolis from $297 in May rise to $578 in July. According to the Airlines Reporting Corporation, the average U.S. round-trip ticket price in April was $585, which was the highest in 7 years. Matthew Howe of Morning Consult said, "I think with tickets being as high as they are, with inflationary pressure hitting people's budgets, people are really expecting airlines to perform and deliver the services that they have promised." Waring, an executive sales coordinator with the healthcare IT company, was able to depart Newark, New Jersey on a United Airlines flight at 8:30 a.m. local time on 21st of May, 13 hours after she was supposed to leave. And the flight was for Los Angeles, California, rather than San Diego, California. Her luggage had also didn't make it on the flight. That meant she not only had to drive 2 hours to San Diego, but also had to visit a Target to buy clothes. And when she finally got her bag, the handle was broken. She kept the receipts from her purchases and hopes the airline will reimburse her. Waring, a 47-year-old who lives in Bud Lake, New Jersey, said fortunately they were still able to prepare for the conference, which went well. She is still planning on flying with United Airlines in August to Florida for a family vacation. Waring said, "The bad experience is definitely not going to keep me from booking a flight." Waring said that the bad experience is definitely not going to keep me from booking a flight, adding, "I'm just going to make sure to have a good-sized carry on that some essentials in there."
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In 2019, the Bradford Literature Festival was the focus of a scandal following revelations that its funding came from the British government's counter-extremism spy initiative. In today's programme, we look at new disclosures about how the Bradford Literature Festival was undermined by the Israel Lobby Searching Campaign. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more after this report by Bianca Rahimi on the festival's disturbing funding sources.
In 2019, the Bradford Literature Festival was exposed to be funded by the British government counter-extremism spy funding. This scandal led to a great number of acts pulling out of the so-called Muslim-led book festival. Now it has found itself in hot water again, this time with funding from the Israel lobby. The festival, which is targeted at the Muslim community, is promising this year to host a talk by war criminal, propagandist and insufferable liar Alistair Campbell. However, a few of the funders listed in the festival programme have more than raised eyebrows in the local community. A key sponsor of the festival is none other than the Jewish Renaissance, an organization presided over by Israel lobbyist David Danger. The Danger family website describes him as a strong believer in strengthening UK-Israel ties. Danger is known to fund the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society, the Israel Lobby Group Board of Deputies, the normalization operation Nisa Nashim, and the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in Israeli settlements, including in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah. The Board of Jewish Renaissance also features at least four figures from the Board of Deputies. The Editorial Advisory Board of Jewish Renaissance also features Alex Brummer, the city editor of the Daily Mail, simultaneous to chairing the Israeli regime-funded Abraham Initiatives and vice president of the Board of Deputies. The 2020 trustees report for the Board of Deputies states that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the IDF. Another suspicious funder of the Bradford Literature Festival is the Aspen Institute, which is led by the Crown family. James S. Crown serves as the chairman of the board at the Aspen Institute, while his father, Lester Crown, was formerly vice chairman of the board. He remains a life trustee and is also on the board of overseers of the Henry Crown Fellowship Program of the Institute. Not only does the Crown family fund the Friends of the IDF and the Settlement Building Jewish National Fund, but also the Jerusalem Foundation, where Lester Crown is also a director. The Aspen Institute has hosted events for Ohad Zemet, the spokesperson of the Israeli embassy in the UK. The Aspen Institute also features Idan Ofer as the honorary chair of the Middle East Strategy Group. The Ofer family shipping company was revealed to be a front for Israeli intelligence. Another cultural partner is listed as the publisher Simon & Schuster. In the past, the company has hosted writing workshops, BLT, and this year is scheduled to deliver an advice workshop on getting work published for young aspiring writers. It is of note that Simon & Schuster published the book Israel, a simple guide to the most misunderstood country on earth by the Israeli government's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and the delimitation of Israel, Noah Tishbe. Bradford Literature Festival is funded by Israel lobbyists, funders of settlements and the Israeli military, and is platforming the key liar and propagandist for the invasion and occupation of Iraq. This is unacceptable.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of a lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined from Belgrade by Kit Klarenberg. Kit is an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. He's recently broken a range of high-profile stories on the role of the British intelligence services in the manipulation of British politics. This includes an exclusive report revealing how the British journalist Paul Mason has engaged in a covert operation with British intelligence to undermine the anti-imperialist movement in the UK and US. Welcome to the show. Kit, I wonder if I could just start with you first. You broke this story about the Bradford Literature Festival in the Electronic Intifada. What's your take on what's been going on there?
I mean, I think this is just the latest manifestation of the Israeli lobby's, you know, relentless quest to infiltrate and co-opt, you know, every sphere of society. We've had academia, politics, and I think that this is... This is the next frontier is culture, literature, and I think one of the reasons that this seemed particularly suspicious to me, and indeed was notable, was the fact that in recent years the Israeli government has significantly ramped up its funding for the arts, in particular film, because it's well understood that film is an extremely effective propaganda mechanism, and its kind of key interest is funding movies, fictional movies that on the surface appear to, promote harmony and unity between Jews and Muslims in Israel, but are actually kind of a Trojan horse to, promote the message that, stop struggling, stop fighting against occupation and just allow yourselves to be colonized fully.
I mean, David, as the film points out, there was a previous issue, wasn't there, with this festival over counter-extremism funding. I mean, is that a new issue? I mean, are there any connections?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Counter-extremism seems to be strongly connected to the question of Zionist lobbying in the UK. So many of the organisations which are funded by the counter-extremist budget are themselves Zionist organisations, and indeed many of the Zionist lobby groups do get involved in the area of counter-extremism. So there's a big crossover there. So the fact that this is an issue about Zionist funding of the festival shouldn't be seen as something entirely separate from the previous issue of counter-extremism funding, because these are part of the same set of ideological ideas. And in particular, I mean, as Kit's been saying here, in particular, the idea is if we just get people together to get to know each other and understand each other's backgrounds, then they will have there'll be less conflict, which means, of course, there'll be less criticism of the state of Israel and its policies.
Mm. I mean, Kit, the Aspen Institute declared as a supporter of the festival, which is supposed to cater for Muslims, and yet the people associated with it have been involved in supporting settlements and the Israel occupation forces, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this was one of the most egregious examples. I mean, what were they, you know, this can only have been, you know, very deliberate. They knew, they must have known the background of this organization. It's not a simple error, like they claimed that their BSBT funding was in 2019. I mean, yeah, this is an enormously influential, you know, kind of international, kind of think tank come, you know, elite talking shop. But it is headquartered in Washington, and you know, it is effectively, it was founded and run by the enormously wealthy Crown family, who have committed and very vocal Zionists. The Institute has a formal alliance with the Anti-Defamation League, you know, which is a leading pro-Israel group in the US, and its stock in trade is accusing any and all critics and indeed criticism of Israel as being anti-Semitic. It has this rather insidious fellowship program, which is about training future leaders, in particular future advocates for Israel, and numerous individuals who are quite prominent in politics across the Western world, and also other fields like journalism have come up through that network. It's deeply disturbing that the literary festival thought that this was an appropriate sponsor.
Yeah, I mean, David, this guy David Danger. I mean, how active is he in the Israel lobby's activities?
Well, Danger's an interesting guy. He's Iraqi Jewish, and he's involved in a lot of cultural related activities. So he's not strongly involved in the more political end of the Israel lobby, although he is a vice president of the Jewish Leadership Council, so he's represented there. Mm. But he's involved strongly in a lot of cultural stuff. He's funds some arts projects, he funds interfaith work, and there's a lot of kind of activity there. And this festival is kind of one of those kinds of interventions. It's an attempt to essentially penetrate the British Muslim community and to normalise Zionism within the Muslim community. So it's a deeply dishonest and subversive activity, but it poses as being something which is softer than the harder Zionist activities. It's a kind of cultural activity which seems to be about people getting on with each other, but actually it's deeply subversive.
Mm. Kit, you, I think, in the past have previously called for a boycott, haven't you, of the festival. Is that still your view now?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that, Alistair Campbell's presence at that festival alone is enough to boycott it. I mean, it's just so, unspeakably tasteless and tone deaf that he would be invited. I don't think that the festival itself will learn any lessons from a boycott, but it's imperative that it happens because, I think people need to know the reality of what this festival is and what purpose it's actually serving. I mean, on paper, it's a very, this kind of, it promotes harmony and unity. In reality, it's the Trojan horse for Zionist interests.
Yeah. I mean, David, do you think a boycott of the festival is possible, do you think?
It's so possible. I mean, there has been a very, very concentrated effort by both the British establishment through the counter-extremism apparatus, the intelligence agencies, and on the other hand, the Zionists, to penetrate the British Muslim community, to try and stop Muslims from opposing British foreign policy. Mm. And the only way in which that can be rolled back is if British Muslim organisations have nothing at all to do with this kind of rubbish. Mm. I would strongly urge every Muslim organisation, and indeed every Muslim cultural producer who may be associated with this in any way, simply to withdraw from this festival, sure, because it's a disgrace.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment and have a look at this report on how the festival seems to be being used as a vehicle for the normalisation of this entity.
A theme of this year's Bradford Literature Festival is touted as In Memory of Andalusia, which focuses on the cultural dialogue between Jewish and Muslim scholars in the Golden Age But is this a clever subterfuge for normalization with the temporary entity in the present context? The roots of this idea can perhaps be found in a talk for key Israel lobby group B'nait B'rith, which took place in September 2021. It featured the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, Saima Aslam, and was titled The History of Interfaith Dialogue Through Culture, Art, Literature and Politics. The use of culture as a tool of normalization with Israel was discussed at length, along with constant smearing of pro-Palestinian activism as anti-Semitism. Aslam, the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, at one point claims that the conflicts, Palestine, can become a lightning rod for anti-Semitism. B'nai B'rith is part of the World Zionist Organization, formerly part of the World Zionist Congress, and states that one of its core objectives is to support the State of Israel. It also states that it is committed to defending Israel from malicious misrepresentation and ignorance. The lobby group even has a Bureau of International Affairs, which engages with the British Foreign Office embassies on behalf of Israel. International Criminal Court documents reveal that B'nai B'rith also submitted observations co-written with the UK Lawyers for Israel lobby group against the, quote, alleged state of Palestine. B'nai B'rith is so deeply entrenched in the worldwide Israel lobby machinations that it even shared an office space with the Israel Project in Washington, D.C. In addition to Saima Aslam, the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, speaking at this normalization event was Elizabeth Harris-Savchenko, who works for the Abraham Initiatives. The trustee report for the Abraham Initiatives claims it exists to increase synergy between the UK and Israeli bodies and agencies. The Abraham Initiatives is funded by the Israeli Ministries of Justice and Labour and works to whitewash Israeli apartheid in Palestine. Clearly, Bradford Literature Festival has been commandeered to serve the interest of the racist Israeli regime to astroturf normalization within the community. Bradford, beware.
David, is this just another example of an apparent use of interfaith activity as a strategy to normalize Zionism?
It is. I mean, we've seen this on many occasions in the show. I mean, we saw a few weeks ago an organisation called Nisa Nishim, which is to bring Muslim and Jewish women together. And, of course, Nisa Nishim is funded by the same people who are funding this festival. This is clearly part of the same kind of thing. They also fund other interfaith activities. The Faith and Belief Forum, for example, another example of an organisation dedicated to subverting the Muslim community and its support for criticism of British foreign policy. So yes, this is a strategy which is developed and was developed by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and which has been rolled out through a whole range of organisations in this country and funded by a whole range of Zionist philanthropists. So yes, this is clearly a part of the strategy of the State of Israel.
Kit, you've done a fair bit of reporting on the Zionist lobby in the UK, haven't you? I mean, did its involvement in the Literature Festival surprise you at all?
No, not at all. I mean, like I said, you know, the culture is the next frontier and it's an ideal audience for, you know, yes, normalizing Zionist propaganda. And yeah, the fact that it is regarded as a, you know, a Muslim festival lends this a legitimacy and a kind of grassroots character when in reality it's, you know, a very, very, very deliberate deception.
Yeah. I mean, and David, I see that B'nai B'rith appear to be very strongly integrated into the Zionist movement. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So B'nai B'rith is an organisation which is international. It started off in the States over a century ago now, a long-term pro-Zionist lobby group. But since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, it's been part of the membership of the World Zionist Organisation, thus centrally integrated into the transnational Zionist movement. It has a branch in the UK. It set up the ADL in the Anti-Defamation League in the US. In fact, it also helped to set up the Union of Jewish Students in this country. So it's very central to the Zionist movement. And it's been part of this literature festival. Now, what we see here is a whole range of different groups. And we see this week after week, don't we? A whole range of different groups whose names probably are unfamiliar to people who are viewing this programme. But they are all you know, within two steps, connected to each other. It's extraordinary, this network of organisations, connected to each other and very similar ideologically and having the same kinds of strategies.
Can you tell us what sort of lessons in general can we take from this whole experience?
Well, I mean, I think it amply underlines the necessity to look very, very, very carefully into, yes, the financial arrangements and the kind of, you know, political or ideological connections of the people who support these kind of events. Because on paper, I mean, you know, Alistair Campbell's presence aside, like, this looks like a perfectly normal and indeed, you know, perfectly agreeable literature festival. In reality, it is serving a very dark purpose, quite clearly. And yes, the Zionist sympathies of its, you know, of its founders are extremely notable, and no doubt like play a significant role in informing, yes, the true unstated purpose, you know, of this festival. And it's, you know, increasingly, as we've discussed, the Zionist lobby is trying to, you know, infiltrate and co-opt every sphere of, you know, society, every democratic space. So yeah, be extremely careful, because, you know, the next time you go to a concert, or the next time, you know, that you attend a, you know, a gallery show, it could be that it is serving some kind of clandestine objective.
David, there was a reference to the UK Lawyers for Israel in the film. What is this organisation?
So this is an organisation which has been set up by a group of people who have some kind of connection with the law. Some of them are lawyers, and which is dedicated to pursuing lawfare, that is, the use of the law in warfare, and to sabotage Palestine solidarity work. It's thought that it was set up at the behest of, and after the involvement in a conference organised by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in occupied Palestine, of course. And we've seen reference to it in a number of different shows that we've done over the past few weeks. It's been involved on campus, it's been involved in a number of different legal cases, and here it's been involved with B'nai B'rith, and indeed at the International Criminal Court, producing documents scandalously talking about the pretend Palestinian state. So this is an organisation which is really very, very extreme, and which is involved with this B'nai B'rith organisation, apparently involved in friendly cultural activities where people are getting to know each other and be friendly with each other. But at the same time, they're involved with this other organisation, which is at the far extremes of the Zionist movement. Indeed, you know, even perhaps beyond the extremes of Likudist politics and towards Kahanist politics. So there's something really very worrying about this whole nexus. On the one hand, in the Zionist movement, there are mainstream Zionist organisations which are, pretend that they don't really like the settlements, but which nevertheless defend the state of Israel, right or wrong. And then there are a whole range of other very right-wing pro-settler organisations, Kahanist organisations, who believe in genocide, straightforwardly. And then you've got the left, the so-called socialist Zionists or liberal Zionists, and they all believe, in the end, in defending the state of Israel in what they call a big tent for Israel. And so although there is differentiation within the Zionist movement, they all are united in defence of the Israeli state's activities, which of course are themselves war crimes.
I mean, this UK Lawyers for Israel, I mean, where does their resources coming from? Are they doing the work sort of pro bono, or is it, or are they being funded?
Well, this is what we don't know. We do know some of the money comes from Zionist philanthropists, for example. Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, which we've had cause to mention in this programme before, has funded UK Lawyers for Israel. But presumably, much of the money comes directly from the State of Israel, perhaps through conduits. We don't know. What we do know is that it has worked with an organisation called Shurat Hadin, which is a law firm in occupied Palestine, which has offices in different parts of the world, and which WikiLeaks documents showed in its early years took direction from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and indeed from the Mossad on which cases to take. And those cases involved things like legal cases against the Gaza flotilla, to try and threaten insurance cases or to threaten ports with allowing the ships to depart, etc. So they've been using law as a means to subvert genuine civil society action in support of Palestinian rights.
And perhaps finally, Kit, do you think this controversy over the Bradford Literature Festival is likely to have an impact on any future festivals?
Well, I mean, as I said, they clearly haven't learned lessons from the 2019 fiasco when, accepted funding without, advertising it particularly clearly from a Home Office counter-extremism initiative, which is engaged in all manner of other astroturf propaganda efforts in other areas of civil society. I mean, I think that maybe the fact that it wasn't that it went ahead and they managed to kind of the controversy blew over somewhat. They thought they'd gotten away with it. So yeah, all the more reason to boycott them this time.
I mean, is your general sense that the Zionist lobby is waning in its influence or increasing in its influence? I mean, what's your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's somewhat a mixed picture. So, I mean, the rather embarrassingly for the lobby, not long ago, they attempted to deplatform Loki from Spotify on completely farcical, fraudulent grounds as ever, and lots of charges and false charges and slanderous accusations of him being an anti-Semite, and it didn't work out. But in other areas they seem to be making headway. So yeah, I mean, I think that and as the recent controversy involving Goldsmiths Student Union demonstrates, you need to stand up to these people and you need to respond very, very robustly, because if you give them an inch, they will take a mile and then some, and they will not stop. So, this stuff needs to be opposed very, very aggressively and robustly.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed, Kit, for your input today. And thank you, David. We're going to have to leave it there now because, unfortunately, we are out of time. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight.
According to a new study, few countries make provisions for the needs of people with disabilities when they make plans for adapting to the effects of climate breakdown. And none mention disabled people in their programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled Study Says Disabled People Being Systematically Ignored on Climate Crisis. Research has shown people with disabilities are being systematically ignored by governments around the world when it comes to the climate crisis, even though they are particularly at risk from the impacts of extreme weather events. Fewer countries make provisions for the needs of people with disabilities when they make plans for adapting to the effects of climate breakdown. And none mention disabled people in their programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, according to the first comprehensive review of the issue. Sébastien Jodoin, a professor at McGill University in Canada and co-author of the report titled Disability Inclusion in National Climate Commitments and Policies, and published on Friday, 10th of June, said the needs of people with disabilities were being overlooked. Sébastien Jodoin told The Guardian, "I was very disappointed by our findings. Countries have not considered how people with disabilities can be included in climate plans. They have been systematically ignored. Yet people with disabilities were among the most vulnerable to climate impacts, partly because of the nature of their disabilities and also because of the social disadvantages that often accompanies this." Sébastien Jodoin said, "These are some of the people who are most marginalized in our societies. They tend to be poorer and they tend to have fewer resources." He noted people with disabilities were already facing danger from the climate crisis. For instance, when Hurricane Katrina hit the United States in 2005, many people who used wheelchair were stranded as there was no plan for their evacuation and they were unable to use unadapted vehicles. Yet few lessons were learnt from Hurricane Katrina. When Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012, the same problems were repeated for many wheelchair users. In response, disabled people took to the city of New York to court for the omission and forced changes to policy so that there must be provision for wheelchair-accessible public shelters. Researchers at McGill University examined the detailed climate pledges and policies, known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, that countries must submit under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, which contains a requirement for people with disabilities to be considered. They also combed through countries' domestic plans for adapting to the impacts of the climate crisis. They found only 35 of the 192 countries, or parties to the Paris Climate Accord, referred to people with disabilities in their Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, and only 45 countries refer to people with disabilities in any national policies or programs for adaptation. Major economies, including the United States, Britain, and Japan, failed to include such recognition at all, though a few, including Germany, Spain, and South Korea, did include a reference to their adaptation plans. Only a handful of countries, including Zimbabwe, Mexico, and Panama, did both. The report found most of the countries that did include specific reference to people with disabilities did so in a cursory manner, without including meaningful mechanisms to consult people with disabilities or ensure their rights are respected. The report found developing countries tended to perform better than wealthier nations. One of the 35 countries citing people with disabilities in their Nationally Determined Contributions, only one was a developed country, and of the 45 countries mentioning people with disabilities in their adaptation plans, only 15 were developed countries, most of them European Union member states. The disparity is likely to be because donor countries, which help countries to draw up their nationally determined contributions as they provide climate finance to help poorer countries cut their emissions and cope with the impacts of extreme weather, often stipulate that people with disabilities and other vulnerable groups, such as children, women, and older people, are given special consideration. But when it comes to domestic policies, that focus is often lost. Sébastien Jodoin cited the British as an example, saying the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office had strong policies on inclusion as a donor, but the UK's national climate plans did not take into account disabled people's needs. People who use wheelchair are among those most vulnerable to the climate crisis, but some of the risk factors for people with disabilities are less obvious. For instance, people living with schizophrenia tend to show a mortality rate as much as 50 times higher than the general population when heat waves hit. That is because their medication makes them more sensitive to changes in temperature. Such people could benefit from better awareness of the problem and measures to cool their homes, but that is only likely to happen if countries adopt a more joined-up approach. The report found governments should redraft their policies to take account of the needs of people with disabilities. For instance, Sébastien Jodoin said early warning systems for storms and extreme weather events should be tested to ensure people with hearing or communication difficulties could be warned in appropriate ways. He said many such measures were simple to implement, but some would require additional funding. Jodoin told The Guardian that connections between disability and the climate crisis were not well understood, even among academics. He said, "I have spoken to climate experts and said, I work on disability and climate change, and they looked at me and said, what does that mean?" Sébastien Jodoin concluded by saying, "People would have said something like that if you had said 10 years ago you were working on gender and climate change."
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing India in a changing global geostrategic environment in a conversation with author and former ambassador M.K. Bhadrakumar. But first, this brief analysis.
In the wake of the Western sanctions on Russia, pressure was applied on India to join these sanctions, which India, like most other non-Western nations, refused to join. India insisted on maintaining its decades-old strategic relation with Russia and the former Soviet Union as it relates to energy and food imports, but particularly as it relates to India's military, which has traditionally used a large percentage of Russian-made hardware and technology. This refusal resulted in the West sending UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to India in order to offer military hardware contracts as an alternative to the Russian strategic relation. In general, the US and the West are pursuing a strategy of using India as a wedge against Asian and Eurasian integration by stoking tensions between India and China and India and Pakistan. Given its size and power, India insists on its strategic independence, and while, for example, it is a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it is also a member of the US-led Quad Group, along with Japan and Australia. As the US keeps raising tensions and stoking conflicts, it's questionable whether it's possible for countries such as India to maintain such a balance between the West and the rest without having to, at some point, choose a side. Like all countries, India too is faced with a rapidly changing geostrategic environment. Since the 19th century, the West's strategy in Eurasia has been to cause conflict and destabilization in order to prevent Asian nations from becoming global powers and in order to prevent a strategic alignment between Asian nations against Western imperialism and neo-imperialism. In this environment, the US and its vassals will use every dirty trick to cause conflict between India and its Asian neighbors, and will use every dirty trick to destabilize India domestically in pursuit of the West's goal of strategic domination of Eurasia. This is the challenge facing Indian elites, as they have to resolve India's strategic challenges,
particularly its relationship with China and its significant domestic socio-economic underdevelopment, so that India does not become a second Ukraine sacrificed by the United States and the West in its strategic conflict with China, Russia, and other rising Asian powers. It seems that India has enough elites who are familiar with the real character of Western nations and who have not forgotten the injustices perpetrated upon the Indian people by Western imperialism. On the other hand, there are also those elites in India who are desperately seeking to maintain their good standing with Western security and financial elites, and their personal and family contacts and residencies in Western capitals and cities, who would be willing to offer India as a platform for Western strategic infiltration into Asia. Undoubtedly, India will be a global superpower in the future if it is capable of resolving its domestic and international challenges without succumbing to the temptation of becoming a pawn of the West in return for money and privileges offered by the Western oligarchy to Indian elites, similar to what we have witnessed in countries smaller and less powerful than India, and which ultimately led to the ruin and bankruptcy of those countries.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You know, when we started the program, it's a new show, it's a new program that we started. One of the first topics that we decided that we're going to do was India, because of India's importance in terms of the geostrategic situation that exists in the world, and being one of the largest countries and one of the most populous countries, and all the reasons that everybody knows as to the importance of India. And of course, the first person we thought of doing the interview with and the conversation with was you, because people can follow you on indiapunchline.com, and you're also a columnist for The Cradle, where you have very interesting articles. I always benefit from reading your articles. They're insightful, and they're also very entertaining as well, which is a rare combination. So I really recommend to go check out your writings on these platforms that I mentioned. So with that, Mr. Ambassador, I want to get straight into it. So in your view, it is a national priority for India to work on its relation with China. Is that have I understood you correctly?
Yes, it is not only my viewpoint. I am strongly convinced that that is also what the Indian leadership is looking for.
Yes.
You know, but you know, it's not something where you can produce an effect in a result in a 6 month period or a 1 year
yes.
period.
It's a long term project.
A long haul, you know,
yes.
And that would be understood also.
Which I think is very important. I mean, for those in Asia now, we're, you know, we in Iran insist on calling our area of the world West Asia, not the Middle East. So for those of us in West Asia, I think it's very important that the two largest and most populous countries in the world who are on our continent would be able to have some, you know, deeper strategic relation in terms of, you know, allowing this part of the world to regain its position as the center of human civilization. Because this is exactly, again, I go back to the way that the West seemed to, you know, be so sensitive about the fact that India was not going along with them on this issue of the Ukraine and Russia. You have immediately the Queen's, you know, Prime Minister coming to India, and you have the European Union, you know, immediately going into overdrive to, God forbid, should India, you know, decide to align itself with this rising, you know, Eurasian integration. So, yes, I think you're right. I think, you know, it is a priority not only for India, but it's a priority for the world. That's why I was maybe indicating a third party, not necessarily, as you were saying, of course, you know, India and China can resolve their own issues. But the idea that the Indian leadership, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in India who grasp this, but on a policy level, on those who are the actual decision makers, grasping the global and historic importance of this issue, of India and China being able to come together. And I would add that maybe this is the worst nightmare for Brzezinski, is if India and China actually decide to align with each other. Forget about Russia and Iran. That's actually those two being able to come to some sort of a peaceful
agreement, that would be a very important thing for India. So, Mr. Ambassador, you mentioned Iran. I want to just briefly touch on that, and maybe then, if we have time, go and talk a little bit about internal issues in India. It's very interesting. You talked about the Americans interfering and getting involved in things that are not their affairs. But unfortunately, we also see that there are some people in India who are susceptible to this influence. We have the Chabahar port in Iran. And by the way, I've visited there. It's a beautiful place. It's really, anybody who has the opportunity should go visit it. It's an amazing, amazing area. And this is one of the things, one of the strategic agreements that exists between India and Iran, which unfortunately the Americans have been trying to, interfere with, which is that India is heavily investing, wants to heavily invest into the Chabahar port, which would then be the port from which Indian goods and products could then enter the Central Asian and North Asian and European markets, that those goods would go to Chabahar and then through Iran would be going to places like Afghanistan and the Central Asian republics, Russia, and so on further, wherever they need to go. And also the issue of the pipeline that would be going from Iran through Pakistan to India, because obviously one of the biggest issues for India, as always, is its energy needs. Iran has a lot of oil and gas, would be very happy to sell it to India. But of course, the pipeline has to exist. One interesting historic point, which a lot of people might not know, is that a lot of India's oil refineries, historically, have been built to refine Iranian oil. Because during the British era, the oil that was in Abadan and in Khuzestan in southern Iran would then be shipped to India and be refined for many years, there was a permanent office of the Iranian oil company, of the Anglo-Iranian and then later the National Iranian Oil Company in India, that was managing this as one of the major customers of Iranian oil. So these things exist, and it's a shame that the Americans were able to interfere in this, because it benefits all of them. This was just in, I mentioned these things just in order to, complement some of the things you were saying. But I want to go a little bit now internally into India, and if I'm wrong, please correct me if I'm wrong, how the internal dynamics within the domestic politics of India might have an effect on this geostrategic alignment, realignment, orientation, reorientation, however you want to put it. We see now from the outside, as somebody who's looking in from the outside, that we have a social, political movement and trend in India, which is, I'm willing to use the word dominating the social and political discourse in India. That we're at a point in India, maybe which hadn't existed prior, where there really isn't a rival to the Hindu nationalist political and social discourse, where Congress is maybe as weak as it's ever been, the Congress Party and that current, that political current in India. And of course, for a lot of people, especially Muslims, there is worry that sometimes you see certain things happening. You saw what happened in Kashmir also in terms of changing the legal status there. But then on the other hand, I remember reading in one of your articles saying that this is also an opportunity because it allows a person like the Prime Minister Modi to basically bring the heartland of India into whatever direction he decides that they should be going, so that this actually could also have a positive effect if India decides to, make those adjustments that are necessary in this new multipolar world. So, again, with all that I just mentioned, if you could give us a little insight into the domestic dynamics that exist in India and how that might relate to the discussion we're having, the strategic and geostrategic discussion that we're having.
Well, it's a big question.
Yes.
I'll try to answer that.
Please.
I tend to agree with you that this is linked to party politics in India also. You mentioned it, you hinted at it, but it's a fact. Much of this is happening also because of party politics in India.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy has taken root in India, but it has acquired, I can say, Indian characteristics.
Correct.
And therefore, you know, some of these things which you see as aberrations ought to be seen from that point of view. I refuse to believe that India can be polarized in such a direction over the long term. It's not possible. In the sense that, you know, look at the history of the subcontinent. There is an eclectic culture. And it is because of one particular political party like Congress Party or anything. But there's an eclectic political culture. And it's a fact that I'm reading, in fact, a very interesting book on Mughal history right now. And I find, in fact, you know, even in that time, even at that time, you know, how, you know, key advisors and so on of the Mughal emperors, you know,
correct, over
a period of time, used to be Hindus, you know.
Yes, so, that's true.
Yeah, so you see, this is part of our civilizational flow. And therefore, I will not magnify it. My concern is this, that in any country where there is any degree of polarization taking place to this extent, it becomes susceptible to foreign interference.
Exactly.
And, you know, the way the Western intelligence organizations, agencies work, they are able to infiltrate these groups. They are able to work on these tensions, co-opt people, and exacerbate these tensions, basically to weaken the country, you know. So, it, especially for a country like India, the degree of vulnerability is very high. We don't realize it, you know, because the present government is supposed to be a strong government, strong in quote-unquote. But the point is, inherently, the country will be weakening if it gets polarized, and it can lead to implosions, you know.
Correct.
And modern history is replete with instances of this kind. You know, so what perturbs me more is from that point of view. Otherwise, my feeling is that, of course, the situation at the moment is rather serious because in many parts of the country, there have been eruptions of Hindu-Muslim tensions and leading to violence. And now tomorrow, for example, if you take Ukraine question, when the Western world propagates this hypothesis that this is about democracy, human rights, and so on, and Russia is trampling upon it, then, you know, it puts pressure on India because India also has its own deficiencies in this area. And when there are deficiencies, you are not in a position to stand upright and speak about values. This becomes difficult. You know,
correct.
There is a inherent contradiction there. If India is a country which wants to assert its strategic autonomy and to be able to speak the voice of developing world, then India should not have skeletons in the cupboard, you know, because this sort of things will tarnish not only, it's not only an image problem, not only tarnish the image, but make the Indian position, I mean, drain the Indian position of credibility, you know, because it's a serious contradiction for a country to espouse values that it does not practice or is
correct.
Values which are being pulled this way, that way within the country.
Correct.
So this is what perturbs me as an Indian.
Yes.
And I don't think it is possible otherwise for a majority community in India to assert itself over the minority communities, you know. Of course, I come from a part of India which is very comfortably placed in the sense that in terms of demography. And it's a part of India where the Muslim community, the Christians, the Hindus they cohabitate.
Can you please tell us exactly where you are in India for our viewers?
I'm from Kerala. In fact, I'm speaking from Kerala at
yes,
the moment.
Yes, yes. It's different than many other parts of India.
So you see, the point I was reaching is this is also a state which you may not know in its social formation is probably the most or the most advanced tips of India.
Yes.
You know, enlightenment has come in its own way with Indian characteristics, but enlightenment has come.
Correct.
Through literacy, 100% literacy the state has. So you see, much of this is also a manifestation of the deficiencies in development.
Correct.
You know, the rock cracks of India, which are still lying in darkness. And with modern education, with creation of job opportunities, the attention will change, you know.
Correct.
And move in different direction. In Kerala, this is what has happened, actually.
Yes.
You know, the Muslims or the Christians are confidently able to think that, you know, they are the ruling elites in the state, you know, and along with the Hindus. So, you see, there is a sense of participation, a sense of ownership, which comes out of that. And people don't look at it then, you know, in terms of putting down the other person for your own good, you know. It's a question of carving the cake, you know.
Of course, yes.
Amongst all. You know,
yes. So, Mr. Ambassador, I think one of the conclusions that I can draw, I'm going to be a little mischievous, and one of the conclusions I'll draw from your things that you said, I am saying this, not you, just so that there's no problems later. I can come to this conclusion that there are two issues which are of the highest national priority for India, which is relations with China and social stability. The idea that it's impossible, regardless of what some of the extremists in India might be saying, of somehow getting rid of the Muslim population in India, or trying to somehow do something that they would not be there anymore. But it is exactly these two issues that you see the foreign powers, who shall remain unnamed, trying to infiltrate into India and trying to press these buttons and trying to manipulate India in a way that they can take advantage of these two wedge issues. Again, this is my analysis of some of the things that you said, that there are issues in India which are susceptible, the issue of China and the issue of the Muslim population, and some of those extreme things that we see on the extreme side of the Hindu nationalist spectrum, because the Hindu nationalism has a spectrum itself of people who are more moderate and people who are very extreme. And we saw in recent years some of the extreme, those on the extreme side of that spectrum, trying to align themselves very strongly with, for example, the Zionists, these kind of anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that comes out of some of the white nationalist and the racist in the West. So we're talking about these issues being things that the West can manipulate. But on the other hand, also, you're saying that a lot of these issues can be resolved in the long run with the issue of development in India. And Kerala being a good model of what India's future can look like in terms of having mass literacy, having mass development, and having the various groups that have been part of India's ancient history and civilization living together in peace and moving forward and not allowing themselves to be used as instruments or tools for foreign powers. So, Mr. Ambassador, we're coming to the end. I would like to ask you to please add anything else you would like to our conversation. Wrap it up, conclude it in any way you'd like, so that we can then end the program.
You know, I can only say this, that, you know, the most important thing, I'll turn it around, your summing up and your understanding of India is absolutely brilliant. I wonder if you've been to India or if you lived in India, because your understanding is really good. You know, seldom I come across this depth of understanding. But the point I want to add is this, that number one, I put development on the top, you know, because that can be an answer to India-China tensions, in the sense that it opens a window of opportunity for the two countries to move to have a constructive engagement, and both will stand to gain out of it. And the second